Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, December 8th, 2022. Big Bend National Park 3,815-acre land acquisition to close in early 2023. A site near Terlingua Creek, which resides within the boundaries of a nearly 4,000-acre property, will soon be donated to Big Bend National Park, expanding protected lands westward. Photo courtesy of the Big Bend Conservancy. By Mary Cantrell. Big Bend National Park. The Big Bend Conservancy, a nonprofit organization which advocates on behalf of Big Bend National Park and acts as the park's designated philanthropic partner, is expected to close on a 3,815-acre land sale west of the park in early 2023. That land will then be donated to the park, bringing to fruition the first part of a plan to expand the park boundary. The sale has been in the works for a few years, but necessary funds for the purchase of the property, totaling $780,000, have now been raised by the Conservancy, and the land is currently being surveyed before the final sales goes through sometime in the new year. The land is being sold by the Fulcher family, who wished to conserve the property for future generations. Because the National Park is unable to purchase land outside of its federal boundaries, the Conservancy is serving as the middleman in the land transfer. In order to facilitate the absorption of the land, federal legislation will have to be passed to alter the park's boundaries. The park and Conservancy were previously working with former U.S. Congressman Will Hurd toward the passage of such a bill, and are now working with the office of U.S. Congressman Tony Gonzalez. I can't say enough about the Fulcher family and their commitment to ensuring that this space became indefinitely preserved, because there's so many development opportunities in the area, they very easily could have handed over the land to any number of developers, said Lauren Reamer, Executive Director and CEO of the Big Bend Conservancy. The acquisition of the Fulcher property is the first phase in the Conservancy's ultimate goal to expand the park's federal boundary by 6,000 total acres, nearly 4,000 of which will be made up by the Fulcher property. The chunk of land to be donated to the park is not a continuous plot. Reamer said the Conservancy is in ongoing conversations with some surrounding landowners to potentially purchase their plots as well, many of which are currently unoccupied, but stressed that no land will be taken through eminent domain. There will be no case whereby any landowner in this area is forced to sell their property, said Reamer. Compared to the park's 800,000-plus acre expanse, the nearly 4,000 acres may not seem like much, said Reamer, but the Conservancy believes the area is important to conserve for its natural features and proximity to the existing national park. All of the precious resources included in that space, I think, create a very important addition to the park, said Reamer, especially being on that western boundary, where you see ever-increasing development on that Terlingua Study Butte side. The project is the Conservancy's landmark land acquisition project, she said, and the first of its kind since their founding in 1996. Reamer said both foundations and individual donors came together to make the purchase happen. The Conservancy also held a fundraising event in Marfa earlier this year, which raised $80,000 for the cause. Working in partnership with the park to ensure we're conserving this ecologically critical parcel of land for generations to come, protecting them from future development or degradation. I think it really speaks to our mission as an organization, said Reamer. The property, which sits at the confluence of Rough Run and Terlingua Creek, was used briefly for ranching many, many years ago, said Reamer, and contains one minimally maintained county road, but for the most part is inaccessible. In addition to containing significant watersheds and riparian areas, the property is also home to valuable paleontological resources and historic sites, including ruins, farmlands, cemeteries, a schoolhouse, and more. Reamer said a potential cottonwood restoration project might be a good fit for the site. Birds, including greyhawks and yellow-billed cuckoos, currently reside on the property, as does an endangered minnow. For us, it's a very ecologically critical piece of land, said Reamer. Park Superintendent Bob Krumenacker said, in the eyes of the park, the additional acreage will help further protect important watersheds connected to the park, as well as the significant fossil features found in the area. It protects 4 miles of Terlingua Creek, which is a critical watershed that then flows into park and into the Rio Grande. Protecting that ecosystem for 4 more miles is really, really important, said Krumenacker. There's some really significant geological formations that are known to contain paleontological resources, in other words, fossils, and the park boundary currently runs right through that geological formation. Krumenacker said the park is not currently planning to develop any public trails or infrastructure to the area, and he does not anticipate the location receiving significant visitation. Once the land becomes a part of the national park, though, visitors will be welcome to access the area. If intrepid explorers want to explore that property and conduct themselves as they would elsewhere in the national park, they'll be encouraged to do so, but it'll be a discovery experience for people, said Krumenacker. Fire destroys home near Cibolo Creek Ranch, by Allegra Hobbs. Presidio County. A fire broke out Tuesday afternoon at a house about 30 miles south of Marfa on U.S. Route 67, leaving the structure decimated, according to Marfa Fire Chief Gary Mitschke. The call reporting the fire came in at around 3:20 p.m., said Mitschke, and the volunteer fire department was fighting the flames well into the night. Firefighters did not return to Marfa until around 11:30 p.m. The fire seems to have originated in the attic of the old rock and adobe ranch house. By the time the firefighters arrived, it had already spread aggressively. By the time we actually arrived out there, half of the house was already involved, said Mitschke. The Presidio County Sheriff's Department had received a call initially and were on the scene by the time the fire department arrived, along with Customs and Border Protection. There was a woman in the house at the time the fire broke out, but she had already evacuated by the time help arrived, thanks to some passing hunters, said Mitschke. The hunters saw smoke billowing from the house's roof and went to alert the woman, who got out before the flames could spread. The department's ability to fight the fire was complicated by the lack of water access in the fairly remote location, said Mitschke. We have very limited water, he said. There's not a fire hydrant, so you only have the water you take with you. We did what we could, but we just couldn't stop it from spreading. The fire's origin point being in the attic also made combating the flames more difficult, he said. The structure's exterior walls remain vertical, said Mitschke, but the interior wood structure and the roof are gone. The homeowners likely lost all of their belongings along with their home. It's probably still smoldering today, said Mitschke. The fire was really intense. The cause of the fire may have been electrical, said Mitschke, but is ultimately inconclusive. Marfa and Presidio County Museum to host Christmas Open House Friday. An image of a Marfa street scene from 1921 will be raffled off at a free Christmas Open House this Friday evening at the Marfa and Presidio County Museum. Photo by Frank Duncan, courtesy of the Marfa and Presidio County Museum. Marfa. The Marfa and Presidio County Museum, located in Central Marfa on San Antonio Street, will host a Christmas open house this Friday, December 9th, from 5 to 8 p.m. All ages are welcome, and the open house will be free to attend. The 1880s adobe home-turned-museum houses historic collections of objects and artifacts from the region, as well as photographic collections of Nancy and Jimmy Keith, as well as Frank Duncan. Museum board member Terry Norman said the open house has been on hiatus for the past couple of years due to COVID, but is back this year in order to welcome the local community. It is mainly to allow the public to come out and see the museum, ask questions they may have, and get involved with the museum if they desire, he said. Refreshments will be available. A raffle featuring a homemade quilt and a Duncan panoramic print of a Marfa City street from 1921, frame not included, will also take place. Raffle tickets will be $5. 4x6 prints of Duncan images will also be available for purchase. The Marfa and Presidio County Museum has had to block off a couple of display rooms due to structural issues to the rear east adobe wall, and the city is currently in the process of further assessing the damage for future repairs. For more information, call 432-729-7000. Marfa Holiday Bazaar brings Christmas cheer to County Courthouse this weekend by Mary Cantrell. Marfa. The Marfa Holiday Bazaar will take place from Friday to Sunday this weekend at the Presidio County Courthouse and feature performances, vendors, and a pet parade, and more. The three-day Christmas extravaganza will kick off on Friday night with a holiday parade at 6 p.m., a new feature of the revived annual event, and a tree lighting at the courthouse. Abby Boyd, president of the Marfa Chamber of Commerce, which hosts the event, said the parade is open to anyone who wants to participate and is meant to get the local community in the holiday spirit. Whether walking, driving, or biking in the Yuletide procession, Boyd encouraged people to have fun with the event and incorporate decor and lights. The sun will be setting, so we're really looking for the holiday decorations to stand out. It's just about getting in the spirit, said Boyd. I want to see that look in kids' eyes. You know that look. That's what we're looking for here, is them seeing magic happen around them. A sign-up sheet for the parade, which is not required but is recommended in order to receive updates about the meetup location and more, can be found on the Chamber's website. The tree lighting and a performance of Christmas songs by the Marfa Children's Choir, organized by Beth Kersey, will take place following the parade. County staff, including Brenda Bentley, partnered with the chamber to decorate the tree. The county will provide hot chocolate and snacks for the tree lighting, which will take place at 7 p.m. on the first floor of the courthouse. The chamber will be selling beer and wine, with all proceeds going back toward putting on their events. On Saturday, vendors will be open for business at the courthouse, starting at 10 a.m. Boyd recommended shoppers bring cash for their purchases. This year, Boyd said a lengthy roster of nearly 40 local vendors will be set up at the bazaar. The vision for this, and now we're seeing it finally come to life, which is so exciting, was always that it features local Marfa makers, businesses, nonprofits. This is an opportunity for them to fundraise, and it's really exciting to see people start to show up, said Boyd. Boyd said because renting retail space can be cost prohibitive for smaller businesses and creators, the Marfa Holiday Bazaar acts as a place for local makers to sell their wares directly to the local community without the overhead cost of a brick-and-mortar shop. Here's a way for those smaller makers to come out and earn some money before the holidays, and for shoppers to get that really special gift that doesn't even make it to stores, said Boyd. There's a lot of talent in the community that we just want to make sure has an opportunity to shine. Vendors include Carolina Catano of Marfa, who will be selling homemade jams, Joanne Williams of Marfa, who will be selling clay ornaments with her business Far West Clay, Kitmar Vintage of Alpine, and Valerie Valerio of Marfa, who will be selling earrings. Julie Bernal of B-Side will also be set up with her trailer-turned record shop at the courthouse. The Chinati Foundation's education department will be hosting crafts for kids. Saturday's food offerings include a Menudo fundraiser hosted by Marfa ISD's junior class, as well as a bake sale run by the National Honor Society. The Mrs. Taco food truck, which travels from El Paso and can typically be found at the annual Marfa Lights Festival, will be open on Saturday and Sunday. Small local vendors will offer a variety of baked goods on Saturday and Sunday as well. 50th anniversary of Apollo 17, when astronauts came to the Big Bend. Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong rehearsed photo documentation and collection of samples near Fort Quitman, Texas, February 24, 1969. Aldrin has a weight bag attached to his right hip. Photo courtesy of NASA by Mary Cantrell. Big Bend, just past midnight on December 7, 1972, 50 years ago this week, the Saturn V rocket carrying three astronauts on NASA's Apollo 17 lunar landing mission launched into space in Cape Canaveral, Florida, illuminating the night sky. Months before the Apollo 17 astronauts embarked on the cosmic journey, an endeavor that would mark the last time man would set foot on the moon, they underwent geological training in the Big Bend region. From 1964 to 1972, Apollo astronauts made nine total trips to the Big Bend. Apollo 17 astronaut Gene Cernan, the last man to walk on the moon, visited the region three times, and his colleague Harrison Jack Schmidt, the first professional geologist on the moon, four times. Apollo 17 was record-breaking. Astronauts spent a total of 3 days on the moon, longer than previous missions, and brought back the largest volume of lunar samples, a total of 741 rock and soil specimens. The famous, heavily reproduced photograph of the Earth known as the Blue Marble was taken by the team on their way to the moon using a Hasselblad camera. Scientist astronaut Harrison H. Schmidt stands by the American flag during a moonwalk on the Apollo 17 mission. Home, that small dot in the blackness of space above the flag, is 250,000 miles away. Photo courtesy of NASA. Pat Dash, who worked in the space program at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C., and served as the executive director of the National Space Society before retiring in Alpine, first began researching the Apollo astronauts' geological training in the Big Bend region 6 or 7 years ago. Having worked with several Apollo astronauts and NASA geologists throughout her career, the story of their presence in Far West Texas sparked Dash's interest. Because of my career, I had access to some sources, or I knew who to start asking or where to start looking, and I just pieced it together bit by bit, said Dash. It was just a classic research project. utilizing her connections and the library archives at Sul Ross State University, including some old editions of the Alpine Avalanche, Dash studied which astronauts came to the Big Bend, where they went, and how their geological training prepared them for collecting lunar samples on the moon. Since starting her research, she has published an article of her findings in the 28th edition of the Journal of Big Bend Studies, and most recently presented the information at the Center for Big Bend Studies, CBBS, annual conference. The first group of astronauts to arrive in 1964, which included Buzz Aldrin, who would later be selected for the Apollo 11 mission, and Cernan, arrived at what is now the Marfa Municipal Airport in April and were welcomed with great fanfare by civic leaders and school children from Marfa and Alpine. Dash came across some local families that still have sheets full of astronauts' autographs from the time period. At the airfield, the crew was met with a selection of makeshift rental cars provided by Kasner Motors in Alpine. At the time, there was no rental car agency nearby. Dash said photographs she reviewed showed a hodgepodge of six cars, including a sports car and station wagon, which were possibly loaned from local citizens. On their trips out west, the astronauts were regulars at the Bienvenido Hotel in Alpine, where they slept and ate meals. The Big Bend region was specifically selected as one of the sites for the astronauts' introductory geological field training for its volcanic and intrusive features, thought to mimic that of the moon's surface. In addition to their focus on volcanic terrain, groups also took advantage of the variety of geological features available in the region and traveled to many sites. We knew that the moon was volcanic. It was dead volcanically, but there were lots of indications of volcanism and craters, so they thought it was a good comparison, said Dash. Dash's 2016 CBBS Journal article included quotes from NASA leaders who explained why the Big Bend region was selected for geological training. "We can't say what the moon is like exactly, but it may be similar to the Big Bend area," said Ted Foss, a NASA staff geologist involved in the training program. Bill Mullenberger, a University of Texas at Austin geological professor and trip coordinator, said the Big Bend region offered the greatest geological diversity within the smallest area in the United States. Astronauts' field training was focused on proper observation, documentation, and collection of rock samples of note. They were trained to analyze rock positioning within the environment, and on one occasion were challenged to identify rocks at a site where foreign rocks, which were planted by training coordinators, peppered the surface. From the beginning of their geology training, they were trained to recognize rocks that were more interesting than just the dirt at your feet, said Dash. Of the relationship between the geologists and their astronaut pupils, Dash recalled how in 1964, at a training site on 118 South, where the group was studying road cuts and layers of volcanic ash, the astronauts were active, running around and hiking up onto rocks, outlasting their field geologist counterparts, who had a reputation for running students ragged. The astronauts were all super fit, and the geologists have to rethink that approach because they were the ones who are worn out at the end of their trip here. So some of the astronauts definitely questioned, "Why have we got to do this?" But they were all in 100% because they knew this was part of what was going to qualify them to go to the moon, said Dash. The group's itinerary included trips to a site 14 miles east of Marathon to study folding and faulting, to Bee Mountain in Study Butte to study igneous intrusion, and to a loop through Big Bend National Park, including a stop at Santa Elena Canyon. Crews would drive back to town along the river road, communicating via radios between vehicles to discuss the changing terrain of the Badlands, hoodoos, and the Solitario. Dash discovered one instance where a group peeled off from the scenic drive to make a beer run in Ojinaga. Astronauts, including those on the Apollo 11 and 17 missions, participated in more advanced geological training near the time they were scheduled to take off for the moon. The Apollo 17 crew traveled to the area the March before their December mission to collect rocks on foot and via lunar rover at the Sierra Madera Astrobleem, an impact crater located in Pecos County. They came to our very own local impact crater and did a dress rehearsal for what they were going to do on the moon, said Dosh. Since the Apollo program's inception, the focus shifted more towards studying craters created by space objects rather than volcanic activity. By the time we got to Apollo 17, from all the photographs that had come back from the earlier Apollo missions, the scientists understood that a lot of the craters on the moon were not volcanic craters, but were craters created by comets or asteroids hitting the moon, said Dosh. The Apollo 17 lunar landing site in Torres Litro gave astronauts access to both recent volcanic and older lunar rocks, which were brought to the surface as a result of impact craters, therefore available for collection by astronauts Schmidt and Cernan. They came back with the oldest rock sample from the moon that was collected over all the missions, explained Dosh. While early trips to the Big Bend consisted primarily of astronauts, geologists, and occasionally NASA photographers and public affairs personnel, later trainings attracted more management personnel who realized they needed a better understanding of the extravehicular activity, EVA, or astronaut movement on the moon while they were back in mission control on Earth. Dosh said the increased interest from NASA leadership on the scientific pursuits of the lunar landings was in part due to the fact that in the wake of the initial success of the Apollo 11 mission to put a man on the moon, the public began to wonder what the purpose of returning was. Partly, it was political, because public interest was waning. We've been there, we've done that, why are we doing it over and over again, said Dosh. So they raised the emphasis on the science and the scope of the science that was undertaken on the moon expanded, because later missions stayed on the moon longer and had more opportunities to go out and explore. The waning public interest in the space program was reflected in the Big Bend region, where the astronauts' later training appeared to garner little, if not any, public attention. Early in the program, it was big news having astronauts out here. Later on, it didn't even make the newspaper, said Dosh. The vision to put a man on the moon, articulated by President John F. Kennedy and spurred by the orbital flight of the Soviet Union's Sputnik in 1957, launched the space race, leading to a period of rapid technological development which the world still benefits from today, said Dosh. Those years of space exploration represented a special time in history where humans rather than robots were sent into space, she said. Now it's a different situation. What do you need humans for? Why are you sending humans? Is one of the big debates, and for the most part, robotic exploration returns greater dividends at lower costs. So it is a different era completely, said Dosh. But NASA astronauts' educational visits to the Big Bend may not be a thing of the past, said Dosh. There have been significant discussions in the past year about what geology training for NASA's return to the moon via its Artemis astronauts will look like. In 2019, NASA announced its Artemis mission, aimed at putting the first woman and person of color on the moon by 2024. We may send them out here again, said Dosh. She plans to attend one of several Apollo 17 50th anniversary celebrations soon to reunite with old colleagues and celebrate the significance of the historic mission. Dosh said she's happy to know there are plans in the works for humans to return to the moon's surface for the first time since 1972. It's 50 years since humans stepped on the moon. I think a lot of people believed we would go back much sooner than this, said Dosh. We've already lost a lot of the expertise that was developed in getting there before because those people are gone. So it's a fine time to go back if we're serious about exploring the moon.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, December 8, 2022. Man indicted in child sex abuse case by Nathan Hewer. A grand jury in the 112th Judicial District Court in Pecos indicted a Fort Stockton man on four felony charges involving sexual conduct with a minor last month. Randy Davila Fausto, 28, was charged with three counts of indecency with a child and one count of sexual performance by a child under the age of 18. The second-degree felony charges stem from three separate incidents that allegedly occurred in a three-month span in 2020. According to court records provided by the 112th District Court, the first incident, which involved the indecency with a child, occurred on May 1st, 2020, before a second incident involving indecency occurred on June 15th. Documentation showed the final incident between Frausto and the minor, which involved indecency and sexual performance by a child, occurred on August 5th. According to Pecos County Sheriff T.J. Perkins, the original arrest for the charges was made by the sheriff's office on February 22, 2021. Frausto posted bond at the time. The inmate arrest report provided by the sheriff's office showed that Frausto was arrested for last month's grand jury indictment on November 23rd. Frausto posted a $50,000 bond and was released on November 24th. Frausto is due back to the 112th District Court for an arraignment hearing on December 12th at 10 a.m. Fort Stockton student arrested for a terroristic threat by Nathan Hewer. A Fort Stockton High School student was arrested on Monday for a terroristic verbal threat that was made earlier in the day in a classroom at the high school campus, according to the Fort Stockton Police Department. A spokesperson with the FSPD said on Tuesday that the student made a threat to use a gun to cause harm during class, which was overheard by a teacher and then reported to the administration of the high school campus. The report was relayed to the district school resource officers, who later made the arrest with the police department. Superintendent Zamora noted that all students need to be aware that any threats made, whether serious in nature or not, will have significant consequence. Everybody needs to know that you can't mess around like that. You can't say that type of stuff. If you say that, you're going to get in trouble, even if you're playing. The student was processed following the arrest by the juvenile justice system, according to the police department. On Tuesday, the school posted the following message to their Facebook page. Monday after school, we received information from staff that a student had made threatening remarks at school. At that time, administrators contacted local law enforcement. The police department proceeded with an investigation and the arrest was made that evening. District officials will continue to work with our local law enforcement officers on this matter. Discipline will be administered according to the student code of conduct as necessary. As always, the safety of our students and staff is our number one priority. County semi-collision results in fatality by Nathan Hewer. A head-on collision between two semis on Farm to Market 1053, 1 mile north of Fort Stockton, resulted in the death of an El Paso man on Thursday afternoon. According to the DPS, a Kentworth truck with a trailer was heading south on the northbound lane for unknown reasons when it collided with a Peterbilt truck with a trailer at 1:30 p.m. The Kentworth truck then caught fire. Jorge Marin, 45, was pronounced dead at the scene by Pecos County Judge Joe Schuster. Driver of the Peterbilt truck, Jose Eduardo, 59, of Odessa, was treated for minor injuries and released. According to the Pecos County Sheriff's Office, the crash happened between 41st and the 43rd lane on FM 1053. Senior Citizens Center to host Christmas potluck on Friday. The Pecos County Senior Citizens Center will host its Christmas potluck dinner Friday, December 9th at noon at the Senior Citizens Center. Ham will be provided and all attendees are asked to bring a side dish or a dessert. The center is open to all Pecos County residents 50 and older with dues running only $5 per year. New members are welcome to attend the Christmas dinner this Friday and sign up. Regular activities include regular skip bow games, quilting, potluck luncheons, 4th of July hot dog suppers, sing-alongs, and several other events throughout the year. The center provides a safe place for anyone over 50 to meet new people and have activities during the chilly winter months. For younger folks, it's a safe place for your parents or grandparents to go during the daylight hours. For more information on the Christmas potluck, contact the Pecos County Center at 432-336-2302. Dear Editor, as Pecos County voters head to the polls to vote on the creation of a hospital district, there's a solution to our county hospital solvency that could save it overnight, except the Medicaid expansion. It's no secret that our hospital is in debt because of the costs of covering uninsured patients. The Medicaid expansion would pay 90% of those bills at no cost to Pecos County or Texas. It would also eliminate the need for the county to constantly shore up our hospital with absolutely no tax increases. So why won't Texas accept this money? The same reason that the Longhorns will never do anything to help the Aggies. The Medicaid expansion is part of the Affordable Care Act, and because this was part of President Obama's signature legislation, the GOP will never accept anything associated with him, even if it's a good idea. I would urge all Pecos County residents to write to Governor Greg Abbott and ask him to accept our own taxpayer funds that are collected and sitting there waiting to be used. You can hate Obama all you wish, but if this hatred means the failure of our hospital, then it has become akin to the scorpion on the duck's back. The failure of our county hospital will put hundreds of people out of work, people whose salaries contribute to our economy. Maybe if they had called it Larry Care instead of Obamacare, it might be easier to accept this money. But right now, the fate of our hospital depends on more money to fund it. A hospital district will help, so please vote for that. But if you want to save it without any tax increases, the Medicare expansion will do so, even after the district is in place. Everything I've written here is easily verified and fact-checked, so please let your conscience be your guide. Thank you for your time and consideration. Signed, Kirby Warnock, Fort Stockton. Dear Editor, I see where the Pecos County Commissioners Court paid $1,800 to an aviation company to remove two coyotes from some ranches. That's $900 per coyote. How about me going out to these ranches on my four-wheeler with my son's rifle? I'll charge the county $9 per coyote. Now we in Pecos County know why our hospital is going broke. Signed, George Pitts, Fort Stockton. Showtime, A Christmas Story, opens Thursday. The Fort Stockton Community Theater's youth group, the Paisano Players, will open performances of A Christmas Story, directed by Reba Subia and Stacy Scheinfeld, Thursday, December 8th, starting at 7 p.m. Other performances will be Friday night, December 9th at 7, and Saturday and Sunday matinees at 2 p.m. on December 11th, 10th, and 11th. Doors will open 30 minutes before curtain time. Tickets may be purchased at the door for cash or check or online with credit card by going to the Fort Stockton Community Theater website. Another special treat will be the Christmas cookie sale in the FMH Meeting Hall next to the theater on Saturday and Sunday afternoons from 12:30 to 1:45. Homemade cookies will be available for purchase in $5, $20, or $30 boxes. Homemade cookies are great appreciation gifts. Be sure to show up early to get first choice. A Christmas Story is a fun play for kids of all ages. Make plans to attend. For more information or reserved seats, call Alice Dirksen at 336-3180.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, December 1st. Weekend snow and ice cause power outages and accidents. The story was written by Jan Cranfill. The low-pressure system that moved through the area toward the end of last week, bringing rain and snow, helped in reversing the summer drought damage as well as causing several power outages in and around Monahans. According to the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration weatherman, David Munyon, quote, "The system was considered a less stable system than most weather systems, setting up a situation for erratic rain and snow amounts across West Texas and parts of New Mexico, making expected precipitation amounts difficult to predict," end quote. The rain, which began on Thursday evening, measured 1.5 inches at one north side location by Friday morning before the snow. Quote, "Monahans was in an area most impacted by rain," Munyon said. The snow amounts ranged from 20 inches in the Guadalupe National Park to 1 to 2 inches around the Carlsbad-Artesia area. Tatum, New Mexico, on the eastern side of New Mexico, received 6 to 8 inches, as did most of the Guadalupe Mountains. Monahans received approximately 1 inch or less of snow, while Pecos received 2 to 3 inches of heavy, wet snow. The Davis Mountains received 8 to 12 inches, with Alpine reporting 8 inches of snow accumulation. Several Friday evening power outages were all caused by snow and ice, according to Encore Customer Service Executive for the Odessa area, Ed Mendez. Quote, "We had 5 different feeders, a transmission line down at various times," Mendez said. The first feeder loss affected 171 Encore customers. The second one shut down power to 686 residents, and the largest one affected 1,200 Monahans area residents. All outages were caused by trees due to snow and ice accumulations on the branches or the power lines themselves. The exact times of the outages and when they came back online were not available on the Encore report accessed by Mendez. Quote, "If wires are old, cracked, frayed, or damaged in any way, they can cause electrical shorts that will trip the breakers, and just like a house, a tripped breaker will shut down the power," Mendez said. Once the tripped breaker is found, then the troubleshooting begins. The source of the problem can come from an old frayed or cracked line covering that is letting moisture come in contact with the bare wire that conducts the electrical current flow. Quote, "I would like to ask the public to please report anything they see that looks suspicious. If anyone sees a line that is sagging or line coverings that have noticeable fraying or cracking in the covers, please call and report the spot to Encore immediately. We will check on it, get the proper repair done, and maybe prevent an outage from happening," he added. Only a few minor accidents were reported in the city and county, according to Monahans Police Department and the Ward County Sheriff's Office. Members of the Monahans Volunteer Fire Department were called to 2 transformers on fire on Friday night, one at 10th and Kenneth, and the other at 2nd and Mabel Streets. Firefighters secured the scene until Encore representatives arrived. Beard pleads guilty to federal meth firearms charges. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. A Monahans man arrested in a September 13th sting operation conducted by the Odessa Police Department has now pleaded guilty to conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute methamphetamine and possession of a firearm in furtherance of drug trafficking. Cullen Eric Beard, age 29, of 1000 South Harry Street, appeared in front of a U.S. magistrate judge on November 16th and pleaded guilty to both charges. Beard's plea is subject to final approval and imposition of sentence by the U.S. District Judge David Counts. According to the criminal complaint, in August, the Odessa Midland Police Department Narcotics Task Force received information that subjects whom resided in Monahans were involved in the distribution of a large amount of methamphetamine. On September 13th, a sting operation was put into place with Beard to purchase 1 pound of methamphetamine. Reportedly, Beard agreed to meet at a convenience store located in the 1900 block of South Stockton. Beard was positively identified by the Narcotics Task Force through open-source database checks, and a criminal history check showed him to be a convicted felon. Based on the information obtained, detectives in unmarked vehicles conducted surveillance at Beard's home, where he was seen arriving in a Chevy Tahoe. A short time later, he was observed carrying a black backpack, which he had retrieved from his home, and later arrived at the convenience store, Taylor's Food Store. Upon arriving at the convenience store, detectives made contact with Beard, and he was found to be in possession of a TT caliber 9mm semi-automatic pistol manufactured in Yugoslavia, which, quote, had to travel via interstate commerce to be recovered in Monahans, end quote. Officers said the black backpack contained between 1,200 grams, 2.6 pounds, of methamphetamine. A subsequent search warrant was then drafted and signed by Ward County District Judge Mike Swanson and executed, and two more pistols were located inside the vehicle, identified as a Walther P-22 and an Armscope 22 revolver, both manufactured outside the state of Texas, along with 3 grams of methamphetamine. Beard was interviewed under Miranda and admitted to distributing over 50 grams of actual methamphetamine for profit throughout Ward County, Ector County, and elsewhere within the Western District of Texas. Sentencing is slated for February 14th at 10 a.m. in Midland. Beard is facing a 10-year mandatory minimum term of imprisonment, up to a life term of a 5-year mandatory minimum term of supervised release, up to a lifetime of supervised release, and/or a fine of up to $10 million, and a $100 mandatory special assessment. Bustos granted bond after federal drug conspiracy arrest on November 15th. Meza to remain in federal custody pending appeal. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. One of the Monahans men arrested on November 15th during a raid conducted by the Drug Enforcement Administration and the U.S. Marshals Service has been granted bond, while another's bond has been appealed by federal prosecutors. Anthony Bustos Sr. of 1511 South Bruce Street was set a $20,000 bond on November 22nd by U.S. Magistrate Judge David Fannin. Bustos also entered a plea of not guilty during his arraignment. To be released, Bustos was required to pay 10% of the $20,000. Other conditions of his release are: he must not violate federal, state, or local laws, must cooperate in the collection of a DNA sample if authorized, must advise the court or the pretrial services office or supervising officer in writing before making any change of residence or telephone number, must appear in court as required, and, if convicted, must surrender as directed to serve a sentence that the court may impose. Additionally, court documents stated Bustos must adhere to the following. He must report for supervision, continue to seek employment, surrender his passport, may not travel to Mexico, must avoid all contact with co-defendants, must remain in Ward, Pecos, and Alpine counties, and all other travel must be approved. As well, Bustos cannot possess alcohol, narcotics, weapons of any kind, must submit to drug testing as required, must remain in his residence every day from 7 p.m. to 6 a.m., and is required to submit to radio frequency monitoring. Bustos' co-defendant, Daniel Ochoa Meza's arraignment was put off until November 29th. On the 29th, Meza appeared in front of U.S. Magistrate Judge David Fannin on Tuesday and entered a plea of not guilty. Judge Fannin ordered a bond for Meza, which was immediately appealed with a staying order of release filed by prosecutors. Meza will remain in federal custody until the appeal is heard by U.S. District Judge David Counts in Midland. Bustos and Meza were arrested after simultaneous drug raids in Monahans and Thorntonville on November 15th. The pair and the six other individuals were indicted on 9 separate counts, including conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute cocaine, aiding and abetting, and possession with intent to distribute cocaine. Both Bustos and Meza are being charged with possessing 500 grams or 1.1 pounds or more of cocaine. The indictment also asked for the forfeiture of properties located at 1511 South Bruce Street, 701 South Wilma in Thorntonville, 2 properties in Anthony, New Mexico, and a 2021 Chevrolet Silverado Duramax. Bustos and Meza have a plea deadline of December 28th, and if no plea is reached, trial is set for January 17th. Council moves on demolition of 2 more dilapidated properties. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. More long-running code enforcement problems are nearing the end as the Monahans City Council orders the demolition of 2 more homes within 10 days. Meeting in regular session last Tuesday, the council held 2 public hearings on the properties located at 805 East 2nd Street, owned by Sanjo Nunez, and 1003 South Bruce Street, owned by Johanna Gray. One resident spoke to the council in favor of demolition of the Bruce Street property. Quote, "I am in favor of the demolition of this property, and I'm glad to be finishing the process," Don Hubbard said. After the public hearings on the properties were closed, the next 2 agenda items were to act on the findings and order regarding the properties. Based on the evidence City Manager Rex Thee presented during the hearing and the report submitted by Building Inspector Joel Melendez, it was determined that the buildings were not safe, were unsafe based on the standards set by the Code of Ordinances, the properties are likely to fully or partially collapse, the properties were constructed or maintained in violation of the City's Building and Structures Code, 1 or more walls leans or buckles to an extent that plumb lines pass through the center of gravity, falls outside the middle third or its base, the foundation is 25% or more damaged, the non-supporting covering of the walls, ceilings, roofs, and floors are 50% or more damaged, the properties have improperly distributed loads upon the structure member, the properties have been damaged by fire, water, earthquake, wind, or vandalism to a point which has become dangerous to public health, the properties have inadequate means of egress, which is required by city code, and the structure does not have adequate light ventilation or sanitation facilities, which is also required by city code. Quote, "Having found the structures unsafe and not occupied and may not be feasibly repaired, the owner will have 10 days to vacate the structure, which means to clear everything out of the home and off the property and to demolish the structure," Thee said. If the owner doesn't comply with the order and demolish the house within 10 days, then the city will step in and demolish it. The city will then obtain a lien on the home for the cost of the demolition. Along with Thee, present were council members Jeppy Wilson, who also served as Mayor Pro Tem for the meeting in the absence of Mayor Adam Steen, Rudy Hernandez, Calvin Carroll, Ivy Valenzuela. Councilmember Richard Hawkins was also absent. In other business, council members approved the 2023 firefighting contract with Ward County. The contract provides $50,000 in funding to the City of Monahans for the Monahans Volunteer Fire Department from the county. Quote, "This is for fire coverage beyond the Monahan city limits, and there were no changes from the previous year," Thee said. The contract runs from January 1st through December 31st. Quote, "We are grateful to the county for the help they give to the city and the fire department and glad to be working for them," he added. The council also approved a septic sewage contract for the new year with R&R Construction. Quote, The contract allows the company to use city facilities to dispose of septic waste from their portable toilets, Thee said. Charges will be 15 cents per gallon with a 200-gallon minimum, $30. Quote, the company does not induce enough waste to hinder our wastewater treatment process, he said. The contracts also require the company to carry insurance, and the city has the ability to shut them down at any time. In final actionable items, council members approved an easement modification with Encore Electric to replace 20 old wooden poles with new metal poles on city property. Quote, this is part of Encore upgrades to phase out the older wooden poles, Thee said. Encore agreed to pay the city $500 for each pole for a total of $10,000 for surface damage, he added. Chevron donates $10,000 to library and Meals on Wheels. The story was written by Jan Cranfield. The Ward County Commissioners Court met on November 28th for a short meeting, having only 11 items listed on the agenda for discussion and/or approval. The court voted to accept a $10,000 donation from Chevron, which is for supporting community programming such as Meals on Wheels and the Ward County Library. The court approved splitting the donation between the two programs, giving each one $5,000. One agenda item was for the approval of the 2022 Colonia Planning and Needs Assessment. The Texas Community Development Block Grant Program serves small and rural communities across Texas with community and economic development funding. The program sets aside 10% of the program's funding for assistance to Colonia communities located within 150 miles of the Texas-Mexico border. Quote, this regional study is to determine the needs for specific grants that relate to utilities such as septic systems and water, Ward County Judge Craig Holly said. This area, which covers the Permian Basin area counties, plus counties to the west and south, all the way to the Rio Grande, will be included in the research study area. Presidio County is in charge of this area study and will gather the information that will provide the basis for grant applications. In final actionable item, commissioners approved paying the county bills. In a separate agenda item, the commissioners approved a seal coating bid for work to be performed in Precincts 2 and 4. The low bid was awarded to Cox Paving of Texas, who submitted a low bid of $1,043,000. Other regular business included the approval of the hospital budget amendments, the officer's report, and review of the hospital's monthly financial report. Present for the meeting were Precinct 1 Commissioner Tino Sanchez, Commissioner of Precinct 2 Larry Hanna, Commissioner Precinct 3 Dexter Nichols, Precinct 4 Commissioner Eddie Nelms, and Judge Greg Holly. The next scheduled commissioners meeting is scheduled for Monday, December 12th at 9:30 a.m. in the Ward County Courthouse, located at 400 South Allen Street. Hosted America selected as broadband internet provider. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. The Monahans Economic Development Corporation, MEDC, board members met for their regularly scheduled monthly meeting on Monday afternoon. The board considered approving one of the submitted internet service provider proposals for the broadband project. During last month's meeting, the board agreed to begin the process of obtaining proposals. The request for proposals were sent to several different providers and included performance and equipment specifications. Quote, we only received two proposals back, one from Delcom and one from Hosted America, MEDC Director Ashley Adalto said. Based on a recommendation from the Broadband Committee, the board unanimously approved a proposal submitted by Hosted America to provide internet services. Quote, the approval will allow negotiations for services related to the broadband network to begin, Carol Faulkner with Faulkner Consulting told the board. Committee members made the recommendation for Hosted America after reviewing the responses received from both companies. Hosted America is a telecommunications service provider out of Raleigh, North Carolina. Broadband committee members include Teresa Burnett, Brian Franks, Ashley Adalto, and Rex Thee. In other action, the board approved seeking bids for the Monahans Parkway flume revision. The action was tabled during the last meeting pending updated plans from Maverick Engineering, which have now been received. The flume revision is needed to correct drainage issues at the detention pond. Quote, due to problems with the flume, the water is coming up over the sidewalks. The sidewalks near the flume will be redesigned to slope in order to keep the water draining properly, Adalto said. In final actions, the board tabled approving a resolution for an easement agreement with Carwash 828 for utilities pending further negotiations with the owners. In regular business, the directors approved accounts payable for the month of September. The financial report, reflecting a balance of $2.6 million in available funds, and minutes of the October 17th regular meeting were approved. Directors present were Richard Irwin, Hal Upchurch, Leticia Rodriguez, and Mary Elena Sines. Kathy Anthony was absent.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.